You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Few discoveries in recent years have spurred as much excitement in the scientific and medical communities as the potential of emerging genotherapies and gene editing to tackle some of the world's most difficult diseases. Groundbreaking treatments will improve the lives of millions of people, potentially treating diseases like sickle cell. But there are also worries that scientists will take this technology too far, using it to modify germline DNA in order to enhance certain traits deemed preferable. Those fears have already been realized. In November 2018, Chinese researcher He Jinkui stunned and horrified the scientific community with an announcement. He had created the first genetically edited babies, twin girls born in China, a medically unnecessary procedure accomplished well before scientists had fully considered the consequences of altering the human genome. Now, a new two-part documentary from filmmaker Ken Burns and Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee explores the history of genetics and the promise, perils, and many questions surrounding modern genetic research. The Gene, An Intimate History, airs on PBS April 7th and 14th. And today, Siddhartha Mukherjee, a Pulitzer Prize-winning best-selling author and doctor at the forefront of cancer and genetic research, joins me on the show to discuss the fascinating story of the gene and those scientists who have worked to understand it. He discusses how the eugenics movement set back legitimate genetic research in the early part of the 20th century, and how even today, the specter of eugenics still looms large, as scientists ponder the possibility of gene editing and designer babies. Dr. Mukherjee talks about how an unlikely public-private partnership accomplished the monumental task of sequencing the entire human genome, and how modern-day gene hunters are using that information to potentially treat some of the world's rarest and most debilitating diseases. He also reveals how that same research could be applied to treating and even curing major diseases like cancer, and how genetic research is currently playing a vital role in the fight against COVID-19. Coming up with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee in just a moment. Siddhartha Mukherjee is a physician, biologist, oncologist, and author at the forefront of research into cancer and genetic therapies. Featured in the Time 100 list of the most influential people, Mukherjee writes for The New Yorker and is a columnist in The New York Times. His 2010 book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, earned him a Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction, and his 2016 book, The Gene, An Intimate History, made it to number one on the New York Times bestseller list and was among the New York Times 100 best books of 2016. The latter book has recently been turned into a two-part, four-hour documentary, which he co-produced with Ken Burns. Ken Burns presents The Gene, An Intimate History, will premiere on Tuesdays, April 7th and 14th, from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on PBS. And today, Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee joins me on the podcast. Dr. Mukherjee, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you made this program with documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, who has been a previous guest on the show many times. This is your second time working with him, I believe. You guys made a documentary together of your book on cancer as well. What do you like about working with Ken?
Well, Ken's a visionary. He understands history. He understands science. He believes that science is not part of, you know, people in white coats sitting in laboratories. He believes it's part of our history. It's part of our heritage. It's part of American history. It's part of world history. He is incredibly insightful. He's humble. He wants to learn, but he also has the capacity to bring human stories to life. He can breathe life into an image in a way that no one else can. And it's been a pleasure working with him.
And the documentary does have a lot of history to it. It gets into the fascinating history of genetic research from Gregor Mendel's pea plant studies in the 19th century all the way up to the sequencing of the human genome and modern genotherapies. To go all the way back to the beginning here, what were some of the early theories about heredity?
Well, you know, heredity has been one of these ideas that people have been obsessed with since the birth of the human species. Why do I look like my parents? Why am I like my parents? Why am I unlike my parents? What do I transmit to my children? The earliest theories had to do with somehow, you know, instructions flowing through blood into your children. And it was only Mendel who later discovered that that genes were the instructions, that the mm-hmm. instructions were carried in this form, in this kind of very discrete form. And it's impossible to understand heredity without understanding genes, just like it's impossible to play music without understanding notes.
Interesting.
Genes are the notes that make the symphony of heredity. Genes are the atoms that make the material of heredity. But before that, you know, people thought that, you know, hereditary information was like a river that flowed through from parents to children.
And the history of genetics is something of a mixed bag, as you point out in the film. In addition to the discoveries and breakthroughs, it has also been fraught with ethical questions, controversy, and pseudoscience at times. One that particularly comes to mind is the eugenics movement. And we all know about the Nazi eugenics experiments and all that. But what really surprised me was just how much the eugenics movement took off here in the United States in the first part of the 20th century. In fact, how many states in the U.S. actually practiced forced sterilization?
Well, you know, what's astonishing is that the eugenics movement in the United States and in the United Kingdom, in England, mm-hmm. predates the eugenics movement in Nazi Germany. I dedicate my book to Carrie Buck, whose story is in the film. But Carrie Buck was one of the people forcefully sterilized, state mandated manner, because it was thought that she was, cognitively disabled, which was most likely, we know, just nonsense, but wow. But the state forcibly sterilized her so that she could not breed any more of her children and thereby contaminate, as they put it, contaminate the United States with people who were cognitively disabled. Now, this was, remember, before the Nazi eugenics movement. And the Nazi eugenics movement learned from the experience of the Europeans and the Americans and took it to its extreme form. This is into genetic extermination. But long before genetic extermination, there was sterilization occurring in the United States.
And to what degree did the eugenics movement set back legitimate genetic research in the 20th century?
Well, they really moved in parallel tracks. The eugenics movement was a movement which was based on pseudoscience, had very little science behind it. Genetics moved in a parallel track. Genetics moved away from human genetics or human studies because of the eugenics movement, I believe, and moved towards simple organisms such as fruit flies and bacteria to understand the fundamental mechanisms. And it was only after, decades after, that scientists returned having understood how genetics works in peas and flies and bacteria to understanding it again in humans. Mm-hmm. And I think the eugenics movement set back our understanding of human genetics, genuine human genetics, by almost 50 years.
And I want to talk about that fruit fly study. Why was the fruit fly study such a big leap from Gregor Mendel's original pea plant study?
Well, there was not one fruit fly study, but many fruit fly studies, and they were centered around Thomas Morgan at Columbia University. He created the so-called fly room. Fruit flies, you know, the amazing thing about fruit flies is that they breed very quickly, and you can follow their genetics very quickly. Several things came out of the fruit fly studies, but perhaps the most important one was the idea that genes were when Mendel had imagined genes, Mendel had imagined them abstractly. He didn't know what they were made of. He didn't know what they were, how they behaved. He just knew that they existed sort of like particles, and these particles moved from parents to offspring through sperm and eggs, but he didn't know anything more than that. The fruit fly experiments established the idea that genes were physical or chemical entities that lived inside sperm and egg cells, and that they were linked to each other like beads on a string. And that idea that they were linked to each other, like as I said, like beads on a string, would eventually lead to the mapping of the human genome and the idea of the genome, that there was an encyclopedia, but it was a linked encyclopedia, that they were beads on a string. And of course, ultimately would lead to the idea that string, as it were, was in fact a chemical, and that chemical was DNA.
Well, I want to fast forward to the 1980s, and the U.S. embarks on what at the time must have seemed like a colossal task to sequence the entire human genome. Both in scope and even in an approach, you liken that to the Apollo moon program. Tell us more about that.
Well, the decision to sequence the entire human genome began as technologies advanced and it became possible to sequence longer and longer pieces of the genome. And several scientists began to advocate the idea that we should have the entire human genome sequenced as a template. And once that template was established, we could compare it against people who had breast cancer or people who had Huntington's disease, et cetera, so that we could understand what the normal genome was and what genes cause disease. Just to make it a little bit more topical, we are living in extraordinary times, as you know, in the middle of a pandemic. But just to remind you, that first human genome took several billion dollars and several years to sequence. But the very same technologies have allowed us to sequence the genome of this virus within months and at 1,000th the cost, maybe even less, of the sequencing of the human genome. So when you think about the sequencing of the human genome, don't forget that the fact that we can fight SARS-CoV-2 or this coronavirus today relies on technologies that were invented very much to tackle the human genome. And if we didn't have those technologies, we would not be able to sequence this viral genome in as short a time as we did in these last few days.
Interesting. So genetics are actually proving useful in battling COVID-19, huh?
I would say not just useful, but essential.
Really?
In other words, we could not have every armament that we have against COVID-19. You know, the oral swab that you take to detect whether you are virus positive or not, that depends on genetics.
Mm-hmm.
The sequencing of a virus depends on the genetics. When we make a drug like a man-made antibody against the virus, some of which will soon come and become antiviral drugs, that depends on genetic technology. The first vaccines that we will make against this virus will depend on genetic technologies. So if you want to understand, I mean, the film was completed long before the pandemic broke, but if you want to understand the language, if you want to understand what a virus is, what is a virus? A virus is a genome that is being packaged inside a coat that parasitizes a normal cell and uses a normal cell genetic apparatus to replicate itself. That is what a virus is. Replication, how a virus makes copies of itself, depends on our understanding of how genes replicate themselves, how our bodies, our cells make copies of themselves. Mm-hmm. So if anyone wants to understand the vocabulary that we're using around this epidemic or viruses or virology in general, that's yet another reason to watch this film.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back to COVID-19 because you wrote a fascinating article about it in the New Yorker recently. But to go back to the film, when they were sequencing the human genome, I think one of the interesting side stories to this film was this bitter public rivalry between a former guest of the show, Dr. Francis Collins, and an entrepreneur named Craig Venter. Can you talk a little about the competing visions that they had for that project and how they eventually came together and joined forces?
Well, there were two projects that were launched in parallel. One was a public project, which was funded by the government. And then there was a private project that was funded by Craig Venter and his investors. And both projects raced against each other. And it was a competitive effort to start with, but eventually these two projects converged, and it was the convergence of the two projects that ultimately led to the successful sequencing of most of the human genome. I should add that there are parts of the human genome that are still not sequenced because they're very hard to sequence. But most of the human genome is now sequenced. And it was a collaborative effort in the end, after beginning as a competitive effort. And the collaboration was ultimately firmed up or announced in a way that was public, because both Francis Collins and Craig Venter and, of course, Bill Clinton, who was the president at the time, made the landmark announcement that the human genome had been sequenced.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. And when they discovered that, I think, 20,000 genes make up human beings, many people didn't want to believe it. After all, a fly has 13,000 genes. How is it that we can have so much in common with every other organism on the planet, and yet we're so different?
Well, that's a big mystery, and we don't know the solution to the mystery. One possible solution to the mystery is that our genes, the 20,000 odd genes that humans have, are deployed in more complex ways. We now know from work done by many people, including Phil Sharp and Roberts and others, that one human gene can make many different kinds of protein products. In other words, it can be spliced in different ways or cut up in different ways. You imagine a word like studio. Mm-hmm. That word could be cut up into different pieces, S-T-U to spell stew, D-I-O to spell D-O, S-T-U-D to spell stud, and so forth. But it's the same word. In the same manner, a human gene and animal genes can be spliced in different ways to produce very different products in space and time and deployed in space and time. That is one possible solution to the mystery of how just 20,000 odd genes can specify an extraordinarily complex thing, such as a human being. But we still really don't know the answer to the mystery of how 23,000 genes can do it. It has to do with how these genes are deployed in space and time. And the analogy that I often use is that of a symphony or a score. A score is a written document. It might be, 200 pages long, and it has notes in it. The Philadelphia Philharmonic can take that 200-page document, make an incredible piece of music out of it. A jazz quartet can take that same 200-page document and make an incredible jazz piece out of it. A folk singer can take that 200-page document, same set of notes, and make an incredible folk song out of that document by picking and choosing pieces of it to play at different times and different ways. Hmm. That diversity allows just a 200-page document, if you're coming back to this this master score, to produce hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of recordings that are totally different from each other in space and time, such that you can make tens of thousands of variations. And that's an analogy that I often use to illustrate how just 20,000 odd genes can generate something as complex as a human being.
And one of the things that makes up the emotional heart of this film is also so many personal stories that you tell. One thing that I found completely fascinating about this is just how many of the leaders in this field became gene hunters in order to find a treatment or a cure for a disease that they either have or might potentially have. It brings to mind one of the leaders in the field, Dr. Nancy Wexler. And then more recently, there is a similarly inspiring story in this young molecular biology student, Audrey Winklesass. She was born with spinal muscular atrophy, and she, along with the help of her mother, is actually researching a treatment for her own condition. Tell us about her story, and is she making some progress with that?
She begins, to some extent, she begins and ends the film, and there's something very poignant about her connection. You know, genetics is a very personal field as well. You know, you might be afflicted with breast cancer, you might be afflicted with Huntington's disease, or with spinal muscular atrophy, and it suddenly becomes your problem. It becomes your story. It becomes your hunt, your quest. There's a beautiful, I will not reveal the whole film, but there's a beautiful moment at the end when we watch Audrey again as she is continuing her hunt. You know, some versions of that disease, SMA, are now becoming amenable to genetic therapy. And there's an extraordinary moment in the film when you watch a young kid treated with one of these new drugs walk. He would otherwise be paralyzed for life. Walk for the first time and start jumping on a trampoline. Mm-hmm. Again, the film is very different from the book. The book has more history. I would say a deeper dive into the 1940s and 1950s. The film is more about sort of personal stories, and a lot more about how these stories link together to form the history of genetics. Mm-hmm.
And you also profile another modern-day gene hunter, Dr. Wendy Chung, who is working on helping a child with a rare degenerative disease called TIF1A. So rare, in fact, that they actually had a hard time coming up with 100 people with this disease so that they could research it. It really underscores the added problems faced by families afflicted with these rare diseases. In many cases, even if Wendy is successful and an effective treatment is discovered, the economics of treating a rare disease are such that how do you make it worth the pharmaceutical industry's while, or is it a case where lacking the economies of scale of a major disease like cancer, a single treatment might cost $1 million or more? Who's going to pay for all this? That's question.
The question of economics is left hanging in the film to some extent. Mm-hmm. Because it really demands a separate film. I mean, how do we pay for treatment for rare diseases? The one thing I have to say is that in the history of genetics, rare diseases have often led to our understanding of common diseases. And that's a very important theme. Our understanding of a very rare disease called familial hypercholesterolemia, FH, led to the identification of high cholesterol levels as a marker for future heart attacks. That work was awarded a Nobel Prize and led to new drugs such as Lipitor and other anti-cholesterol agents that have dramatically changed the risk of having a heart attack. So it's always important to remember that what rare diseases in genetics can become portals to our understanding of more common diseases. I mean, who would have suspected that understanding this rare, unusual syndrome called familial hypercholesterolemia would lead to a drug that would save hundreds of thousands of lives every year from heart attacks.
And in talking about more common diseases, you have spent your life's work focusing on cancer. And in this documentary, you actually say that cancer, quote, is a disease of the genome more than any other disease. What do you mean by that, Sid?
There is, you know, cancer is a genetic disease at its very core. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean that we now know that the reason cancer occurs is because genes are mutated in cells, and these mutant genes change the division of cells, make the cells unable to stop dividing. They change the metabolism of the cell. They make the cell able to utilize metabolic pathways that were otherwise it would not utilize. They make the cells essentially immortal. And it is the consequence of multiple genetic mutations in cells that makes cancer become cancer. So cancer is the pallbearer or the quintessential genetic disease that we have ever encountered. And understanding cancer genetics has really transformed our ability to understand cancer and to provide new therapies against it.
And cancer is one of the areas where this new CRISPR technology shows a lot of potential. Up to recently, much of the research has been focused on treatment, but now CRISPR has opened the door to the possibility that we might even be able to cure many of these diseases. How exactly does CRISPR work?
CRISPR or Cas9 is a, I would rather broadly refer to this as gene editing. These are tools that allow us to make deliberate changes in the genomes of cells. Again, imagine your genome as a symphony or a conductor score, 200 pages long. And someone says to you, go and change one note in that score. In the past, it was impossible to do that without random mutation. CRISPR-Cas9, as well as new gene editing technologies, allow us to do exactly that. It allows us to go into a genome of a cell and make a deliberate change, a B flat to a C major in one page of this encyclopedia. The human encyclopedia of the, you know, has 3 billion letters. CRISPR-Cas9 allows us to change one of or two, erase and potentially alter these letters in ways that are deliberate. Now, we don't know. There's still many puzzles to be worked out. I mean, does it make a mistake? Does it go and change the wrong letter in the wrong page? But largely speaking, these technologies have transformed the way that we can attack or change the letters of the human genome, 3 billion letters, but the possibility of being able to change what we want to change at a given time.
And in more recent years, many of the scientists who are at the forefront of this research have actually been at the head of a global effort to pump the brakes on CRISPR technology in human embryos. What have been the main concerns driving that?
Well, we want to use CRISPR safely. We want to use CRISPR in a way that's ethical. We want to use these technologies, gene editing technologies, in ways that are don't harm humans. The film begins with, I don't want to give the front of the film away, but with staggering footage of a Chinese doctor, a scientist who climbs on the stage in Hong Kong and announces to the scientific community that he has made basically designer babies, genetically designer babies. He's deliberately altered the genomes of two babies who've been born and done so without really the full consent of the world's scientific community. And that's a line in the sand. We are now capable of potentially making changes in our own genomes. We're machines that are changing our own codes of instruction. And we need guidelines about how to do this safely. We need to understand whether it's a safe technique or not, whether these children will suffer consequences in their lifetimes, and under what circumstances we should and shouldn't do this as we move forward.
Let me ask you this. What exactly did that research alter in those twins?
So this was work done by Jianqi He, and he tried to alter a gene that increases the resistance to HIV in these two children. Lulu and Nana are their names. We don't know their real names because they're being kept anonymous. They're two babies.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here. What's the difference between genetically modifying an embryo to protect against HIV versus genetically editing a disease like cancer in a living person?
There are many problems with the experiment. One is that the risk of these children having HIV was actually zero, in the sense that they were their fathers had HIV, but the mothers did not, and the chances of them getting HIV through paternal transmission is essentially zero. That's one problem. The second problem is that we don't know all the details of the research. We don't know all the, because there hasn't been no formal scientific publication of it.
Aside from the ethical implications of this sort of thing, do we even understand what kind of unintended health consequences this might have for a patient?
All we do know is that these kids, the genetic alterations that were made in these kids are not exactly the same as the genetic alterations that were intended. In other words, the genetic alteration has its own errors, and we don't know whether the other alterations were also made. And finally, because these kids have no or negligible risk of contracting HIV, the question is, was there any additional harm done to them by deleting this gene? And the answer is potentially yes. We know that the deletion of this particular gene called CCR5 may increase their risk for acquiring or being having a severe variant of things such as West Nile virus. So this was a very ethically complicated experiment, and it should have really been done under much greater care with much greater support from the international community rather than a slapdash effort in China.
Well, before we go, to bring it back to the coronavirus, I mentioned earlier that you recently wrote a fascinating op-ed for The New Yorker titled, "How Does the Coronavirus Behave Inside a Patient?" And in this piece, you pose three important questions, the answers to which could change the way we isolate, treat, and manage patients. Can you walk us through those?
Well, I mean, the basic thing that I was arguing for is that we should be using genetic techniques to understand how much virus or what the viral load is. We've been treating coronavirus infection as a plus-minus phenomenon, infected, uninfected, symptomatic, asymptomatic, plus, minus. But what we really need to understand is how much, what the load is in a human being, how much quantitatively they're shedding, and how much load there is in the human being when they actually get sick, and whether we can use that to predict whether they will get the severe version of the disease or a mild version of the disease. Because one of the mysteries about coronavirus is, you know, we still don't know who's getting a mild version of the disease and who's getting a more severe variant of the disease. Just if you look at doctors and nurses, they seem to be disproportionately affected by severe variants of the disease. And that may be because they're exposed to much higher viral loads. And if that's the case, what we should be doing is we should be protecting them more with appropriate protective equipment, including the appropriate masks. Mm-hmm. In contrast, if you look at a more casual interaction, someone sitting next to you on a bus or a grocery store, we could get by. I think we still need masks to decrease the viral load, but those masks could be simpler surgical masks, not N95 respirators. If you look at a patient and find out that their viral load is high and is climbing, we might target that patient towards more aggressive care. We might put them on the ventilator quicker so they can heal faster. So a quantitative measurement using genetics of the virus will change the way we treat and isolate and quarantine and think about protecting ourselves from the virus, rather than just a plus minus, here's the virus, here's no virus phenomenon. And that's the basic argument of the article.
And this whole conversation has been so interesting to me. Again, Ken Burns presents The Gene, An Intimate History, will premiere on Tuesdays, April 7th and 14th from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on PBS. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, thanks so much for talking with me, and stay safe.
And stay safe too, and thank you so much.
Thanks again to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee for coming on the show. Part 2 of The Gene, An Intimate History airs April 14th on PBS. And you can stream both parts 1 and 2 on PBS.org or other PBS streaming platforms. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.